ladies and gentlemen. Welcome again to another edition of Liberty Unbridled. I'm your host, Ken Molman, and this is the My View Matters radio network. Hey, if you'd like to call in tonight, the number here is area code 858-683-1326. We've just got general news tonight, no special guests, and so we'll be returning to the format. We'll go through the first half of the show and talk about the issues, and then we'll take your calls during the second half of the show. So if you'd like to call in about anything we talk about tonight, the area code is 858-683-1326. All right, so to get started, as usual, we're going to start with the random political rhetoric generator. Tonight's randomly generated political rhetoric is, I refuse to support an America where street gangs and filthy hobos can make a mockery of our Bill of Rights. Always enjoy the rhetoric generator. It's always entertaining. Hey, from a couple of weeks ago, we had Katie on about industrial hemp a couple weeks ago, and I meant to mention it last week, but we had another guest on last week, so we didn't get to that. We did do some research on how much of Henry Ford's car was or wasn't hemp, or what the heck was going on with that. There were a handful of interesting things that came out of that research. Number one, nobody actually knows what his car was made out of. The original recipe, as it were, has been lost, and so there is no definitive answer on that. Based on the newspaper articles that were out at the time, it was not entirely hemp. It was hemp was a part of the recipe, according to a newspaper article, but it seems to be somewhere between 7 and 15% of the material, not 100% for sure, and not even necessarily a majority. Now, that doesn't discredit hemp as a usable material. It certainly doesn't mean that it should remain illegal for use. It just, you know, in the interest of bringing you the information that we have and have available, I just wanted to kind of clarify that. And, you know, in the end, on the hemp thing, the market will decide. And that's pretty much what comes down to on everything anyway. So speaking of laws, you know, we got our industrial hemp law last year in Kentucky, and then we got the federal law this year, and the programs are spinning up the test programs, and I'm sure we'll check in again here in a couple months to see how that's progressing, you know, along once we're into the full-blown growing season and see how things are going, and then, you know, at the end of the growing season, we'll check in again and see how that went. But this legislative session saw a number of issues that I personally was following, and I think that it's worthy of noting what's kind of come out already. Now, the General Assembly still has a few days left to do some work, but it's pretty much over now. The session's drawing to a close, and the Inquirer here in Northern Kentucky had a story that basically outlined winners and losers for this General Assembly session. They have a winner as the people who oppose using tolls for the Brent Spence Bridge. Now, I know those of you in Louisville, you guys are stuck with tolls. I'm sorry to tell you. You should have fought that harder. But the tolls are... Tolls are always an interesting thing, and libertarians do support tolling. We support paying for what you use. However, in this scenario, the problem is that they're not removing the fuel tax. They are adding an additional fee on top. And so basically, it creates a disproportionate burden on certain areas to pay for infrastructure than for others. And so there's a legitimate complaint to be had that if you're going to toll, then everything should be tolled or nothing should be tolled, either way. We do have the fuel tax, which is a consumption-based tax. It is based on the number of gallons you consume. And typically speaking, larger vehicles that do more damage to the roads, more wear and tear, also consume more fuel. And so in a way, it makes sense that the fuel tax, the way it works. However, with new alternate-fueled vehicles, the fuel tax is not a long-term solution. When we start talking about electric cars and solar powered cars and whatever power cars, hydrogen powered cars, which I think I saw an article about Toyota's trying to get their hydrogen powered car rolling here in America, the gas tax isn't going to cut it. You're going to have people that are free skating, and nobody's for, well, the only people for allowing for that are in favor of free skating are the people who are engaging in the free skate. But it's obviously not a long-term solution to continue with the fuel tax. So this discussion will continue. I'm quite sure that we have not heard the last of tolling. And even though here in Northern Kentucky they did get a resolution or a law passed that specifically prevents the public-private partnership programs from being used to fund a toll, bridge, whatever project in Northern Kentucky, I'm quite sure that that's not going anywhere. Another one that they mark as a winner is drug treatment. And essentially, they're going to this bill allows traffickers of heroin, large traffickers of heroin, who then subsequently down the line, one of their customers, whether direct or indirect, ODs, the trafficker will be able to be charged with a homicide. I don't know how I really feel about that, but whatever, that's one of the things it does. This bill is right now in the House. It hasn't been passed by the House. It's passed by the Senate. But Speaker Stumbo says that he is quite sure that something will come out of the House and that something will pass in that regard. One of the other things they're talking about is actually increasing funding for treatment, which I think is a very wise thing to do. Providing treatment actually reduces costs overall because you end up with fewer people in jail. You end up with fewer people dead. If you create an avenue for people who recognize they have a problem to get help without the fear of being arrested, then those people who find themselves in that situation are far more likely to actually seek treatment. It also, now that's controversial. This bill also includes a needle exchange program, which I was unaware that it had a needle exchange program in it. That's actually quite controversial. The idea is to help stop the spread of HIV, hepatitis C, and other diseases passed by sharing needles. I had no idea that snuck in there. That's going to be very, very interesting. Skipping over some of the other local stuff here. They also mark a winner of Adam Edlin when Edlin was pushing for a cybersecurity bill and claiming that Damon Thayer, Senate Majority Leader Damon Thayer, was blocking it. The bill requires public agencies to notify people if their personal information has been hacked or stolen or lost or whatever. And that's a good thing. Edlin accused Thayer of holding up the bill. Meanwhile, Thayer said, I'm not holding up the bill, whatever. So I don't know how much of a real win that is per se, but it did pass at the end of March and is now on the governor's desk. One of the losers category here, the first one they mark is Rand Paul, and that is specific to the bill that they tried to pass to allow him or any Kentuckian to run for more than one office. Right now in Kentucky, your name can only appear on the ballot one time. And so, for instance, in Wisconsin, when Paul Ryan ran for vice president in 2012, he was on the ballot both for U.S. Senate and for vice president. The idea being that if you lose your vice presidential bid or presidential bid, that you can still be elected to the Senate and retain your seat. Or alternately, if you win your bid, then you immediately vacate the seat you just won, the Senate seat in that scenario. And the governor gets to appoint a replacement for U.S. Senate, if I'm not mistaken. Yes. So I guess the point is that that bill is not going to go anywhere, and I knew it wouldn't go anywhere. It's kind of funny, and understand it's this is all politics, and it's been all politics from the beginning. So Kentucky, this law, Republicans in the Senate tried to get it changed because there is it's not a secret. Rand Paul is gearing up for a 2016 election, but his U.S. Senate seat is also up in 2016. And so they tried to pass this bill to specifically address that issue. And in return, the Democrats, recognizing that this is a political ploy for Rand Paul, basically refused to hear it, refused to move the bill forward and, basically, Speaker Stumbo's like, "Oh yeah, we're still reading that. We can't really, what does it say? We don't really understand it." And somebody responded with, "Hey, the bill's only one paragraph long," and he said, "Quote, well, it's only two offices. One says Senate, one says President. That isn't even a whole sentence. Check one." So the point is that that law is not going to change. In the end, it's probably not going to matter. Here in Kentucky, the way the system works, our primaries are so late anyway, it doesn't matter in the presidential race. So in Kentucky, the easy answer is just run for the other office. Don't run for president, Kentucky. You've got 8 electoral votes total in the state. Most of the presidential candidates are decided by Super Tuesday anyway, which is in February. And by the time Kentucky's primary rolls around, it's almost certainly a done deal. Now, certainly there have been exceptions. If I remember correctly, in 2008, Hillary and Obama were still going at it. By the time the Kentucky primary rolled around. But again, Kentucky didn't tip it one way or the other. I'm quite sure, given the choice, Kentucky Democrats would choose Hillary Clinton over Barack Obama. But that didn't seem to matter very much, did it? So the point is that in the end, it's kind of a moot point. I think this is actually more about providing political cover for Rand Paul, that basically, when he goes and he does file for U.S. Senate in Kentucky and he files for president everywhere else, when the media asks him why, he's going to be able to turn around and say, well, the Democrats in the state house in Kentucky were dorking around and they weren't being serious and they were being partisan. And it's just giving him a reason why he's running for Senate in Kentucky and running while he's running for president everywhere else. And that's what I really think is happening there. One of the other people they mark as a loser in this whole thing is the libraries. Now, for those that are unaware, and we probably actually should do a show on taxes and specifically the library tax, the libraries have basically been, based on bad advice given to them in the past, illegally raising taxes. And before anybody whines and says, no, they haven't, two judges say they have. So, and that is where the case currently is. There's lawsuits in, I believe, 5 counties at this point. I know Campbell and Kenton and Montgomery, and I believe that there are 2 others. Those are the only 3, though, that I'm following closely. I don't know what the other 2 suits are doing. That case is in the Court of Appeals. But essentially, Kentucky law outlines a specific procedure for libraries to increase their taxes, and it's different than every other taxing entity in the state. It's unique to libraries. And it is a broken, flawed mechanism. It's a formula from a time when turnout used to be much higher in elections. And so you can actually end up with 2 competing initiatives to simultaneously try to raise and lower the library tax at the same time. And then what? Who wins? Who loses? I don't know, because the way the process works, it never even goes to a vote, which is goofy. So while the law is broken, the libraries wanted to make it so that they could just keep, the library boards, that is, wanted to keep being able to raise taxes without any accountability to the voters. They wanted to be able to just say, yep, we're jacking your taxes up. We want to remain unelected. We want control of our budget, and we want taxing authority, and we don't want anybody else to have anything else to say about it. And that's obviously not a realistic solution. The folks that were involved in all of this, that in the suing of the libraries and whatnot, put forth several different alternatives that are viable solutions, that are workable solutions, that make sense, and make sense within the context of the rest of Kentucky law. And the library boards were very much against those because they gave accountability for the tax rate to the taxpayers. And they fought it. They pushed a bill that tried to go back in time and redefine legislative intent from 30 years ago, and it was a mess. It was a crazy mess of a bill. It only would have led to more lawsuits. So in the end, the libraries didn't really lose per se. Taxpayers won, at least temporarily, until the courts continue to ride this thing through. Meanwhile, you know, there are still discussions ongoing on how to fix this problem long term and provide accountability. Another loser were the horse tracks and getting casinos. Those of you who have listened to the show in the past when we've talked about this know that I oppose giving a monopoly to the horse tracks when it comes to expanded gaming. I think that if you're going to have expanded gaming, it should be available to anyone who wants to facilitate that activity. And the problem we have down in Frankfurt is that you have two factions. You have the no gambling no matter what faction, and you have the horse tracks need to have casinos faction. And nobody's talking about, hey, how about we just let people gamble and let places that want to let people gamble there, let them gamble. Nobody's talking about that. Or even within the context of Kentucky law, again, why not let people vote, just like we vote on alcohol? Right, there are wet and dry counties in the state. Why can't we have gambling and non-gambling counties based on the vote of the people of that county? Really simplistic solutions to this stuff, but they don't directly benefit any special interest groups, and so therefore they don't get heard. There's no money pushing them. There's no lobbyists pushing for them, and they're not going to go anywhere, and that's that. The last loser that they list here were the felons, the former felons trying to get their rights restored automatically. The various groups, and Libertarian Party, for instance, was part of these groups that said, hey, once you've done your time and you've finished out everything as a result of your sentence, there should be a process, a legally defined, standardized process to get your voting rights back. Today, the process in Kentucky is you have to ask the governor to pardon you. And what that really means, based on people that I have talked to that have gone through the process, and this is whether you're a Democrat or Republican governor, you basically pay somewhere between $10,000 and $15,000 to the correct lawyer who's tied in to the right political establishment circles, and they get it done. And, it just so happens those lawyers are big donors to that particular gubernatorial candidate. That's funny. Funny how that works. So the problem is the current process encourages corruption. It encourages inequitable treatment, and creating a standardized process would resolve that. Unfortunately, it requires a constitutional amendment, and it looks like that's not going to happen. The bill basically died in the Senate. It's over there. They've gutted it. They've changed it. They've moved it around. It's what it is, but it looks like it's not going to go anywhere. So those were the stories that the Inquirer felt were important enough to report on from the General Assembly session. There were certainly others, and we'll bring those to you, in the next few months over the time of what passed, what didn't, and where to go from here. Oh, let's see here. Hey, did you know the economy's bad?
Yeah, I know we talk about this a lot. One of the things I always like to look at is the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the workforce participation survey. And actually, this past month we had a slight uptick. We're just above 63% of those who are able-bodied, those who could work, are actually working. I think this number is a better number than the unemployment rate because the unemployment rate is dorked with pretty heavily. They just assume people have given up looking for work and then they don't count them anymore. It's like it doesn't make them unemployed. It just makes it so that they've been unemployed a really long time. But that's the way government math works. And so that's why I like to use the labor participation rate as a better baseline. It gives us the real picture of who could be working, able-bodied Americans who could be working, what percentage of them are working. And that percentage in March was 63.2%. So a slight uptick. But what's scary, and I saw this here, and I'm missing my tab here. The Census Bureau, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, rather, is actually predicting that that number will continue on a downward trend over the next 10, 20 years. And that's kind of scary, actually. We're going to continue to have fewer and fewer able-bodied Americans in the workplace. And does that mean that they're on social programs? And if so, does that mean that the rest of us who do have jobs are going to be paying a higher and higher percentage of our incomes to subsidize those that are not working? And I really worry because based on what I saw, it's going to dip down somewhere around 50%. Now, that's really low. That means half the country's working, the other half is just, hanging out. And that's not cool. And that's not to say those people are trying to be just hanging out, right? I mean, there's plenty of people out there that I know who have been trying to work. That there's plenty of people out there I know that have multiple part-time jobs because that's the only work they can find. The economy is still in really bad shape. And, what's interesting, and this was a graphic for something else, it was more about the minimum wage, but, it also has information, the information that's here is about the labor participation rate for people aged 16 to 19. And that number has dropped significantly since 2008. In 2008, age group 16 to 19-year-olds in 2008, about 43%-ish were employed, which is not bad. I mean, you're talking about 16 to 19-year-old kids. I mean, some of them are in high school still. They're still, they're kids. And so it doesn't surprise me they would be lower than the, say, a 30-year-old, that range. But since 2008, that number has slid significantly until 2012 or so, when it bottomed out at just under 35%, somewhere between 34 and 35%, and has basically been hanging out there ever since, which means that amongst our young adults and 16 and 19-year-olds, there's been a drop of 12% of all 16 and 19-year-olds, there's 12% are not employed when in the past they, in theory, would have been. And it's just kind of amazing to me that I don't even know what to say about it. I mean, I hear stories all the time about teenagers who are trying to get jobs and can't get jobs because the jobs they used to have, working at McDonald's or working in some sort of relatively low-skill service job is no longer available because there are still 20s and people in their 20s and even in their 30s working these jobs. And so because there are people, older people, who can't get up the pay scale, can't move up and find better work, making it so that the young folks can't get work either. You know, it has a ripple effect down the line. And I just, it's amazing to me, you know, things aren't getting any better. And, you know, here this week we heard about Fruit of the Loom. Fruit of the Loom down in Jamestown, Kentucky, is shutting down. And there's about 600 people that are going to lose their jobs by the end of the year. That's probably in line with about 600 families. There might be a few families where both parents work there, but chances are really good that it's about 600 families directly affected by this closure. And, you know, this is kind of a big deal. There are, you know, a lot of folks, you know, these manufacturing jobs are really hard to get now. And the area where this happened, they said there's about 2,000 manufacturing jobs there total. So you're basically wiping out one-third of all the manufacturing jobs in the area. And that's going to have also a ripple effect down the line. You're talking about people no longer able to pay their mortgages, so you're going to have foreclosures. You're talking about people who are just moving out to try to find other work, so people are going to be selling their houses cheap. So you're going to see the market for housing depressed by this. Well, based on how Kentucky taxes work, that means that everyone who's left is going to end up with a higher tax burden, and they're going to have to pick up where these folks are no longer able to pay. So, and of course, everyone knows most people aren't getting raises and haven't had a raise or have only had one or two, you know, quote unquote, cost of living increases over the course of 6 or 8 years. You've gotten a measly 6% increase overall, while the cost of everything has gone up more and more and more. And this is going to have an ugly ripple effect. And, you know, it's not a story unique just to Kentucky. This is happening everywhere. Things are not well in the country. And you see this in job approval ratings. Congress's job approval rating, or rather this one here, this poll is the direction of the country. Right now, 61.8% of Americans believe that the country's on the wrong track. Only 30% of Americans believe that the country's on the right track. And there's that miscellaneous 8.2% that don't know what day it is. I always find those people entertaining. You can't decide whether or not you think the country's on the right track? Really? And there's less and less trust in government. A study here done by Gallup shows that people are less and less trustful of the government. Here in Kentucky, 4% of Kentuckians, 4%, the number four, have a great deal of trust in their state government. I believe that may be part of the aforementioned 8.2 that don't know what's going on. But 4% say, I have a great deal of trust in their state government. 49% say that they have a fair amount of trust in their state government, which actually I find to be a little bit high, but hey, that's cool. 31% so they don't have very much trust in state government. And 16% say they have no trust at all in their state government. So it's kind of amazing to me the number of people who have a great deal or fair amount of trust in our state government is just barely above water at 53%. And as things continue to get worse, as the economy continues to be in this prolonged recession, and as our legislators and local leaders continue to not know what to deal with or how to deal with this, and again, as I've said before, this is not just a Kentucky phenomenon. It's going to be harder and harder and harder for people to continue to take these lumps. And things are changing. There was a recent story here from a couple weeks ago where a special election for a state Senate seat in Pennsylvania was won by a write-in candidate against a Democrat and Republican. It was a three-way race. Two listed on the ballot. One was a write-in candidate, and the write-in candidate won, which is a pretty significant task. I've always told folks that here in Kentucky, you can run as a write-in, but typically it's a complete waste of time and money and effort. There are too many people that go to the polls and push straight party ticket, much less going to the polls and remembering to write someone's name in. I've always joked, because here in Kentucky, if you want to run as a write-in, it's a $50 filing fee. I've always joked, hey, you know what? A better use of that $50 would be to set it on fire, because at least it provides a slight bit of heat before it's gone. Speaks to how much things are changing. I think that this points to new political opportunities, because people are sick and tired of the status quo. If you look, we're 8 years really into this recession, and pretty much everybody's saying, yeah, well, we're just never going to come out. This is the new normal. That's not cool. And governments who are built upon the ever rosy pictured growth in the economy are struggling to pay their obligations, because they made obligations based on ridiculous, never could be sustained in the economy. And so they resort to things of getting people to pay for things in other ways. North Carolina is talking about adding a per mile tax on top of the fuel tax. I'm against that. That's ridiculous. Just raise the fuel tax. I mean, what the heck? Why would you add two taxes? Or get rid of the fuel tax and just do it per mile? It's just stupid to do it twice. Other municipalities are finding fees and other things to ratchet up their income at the expense of others. I don't know about you. I've seen in the past few years a real ratcheting up of traffic enforcement, because that's a great bit of free money, quote unquote, for the state. And I've seen a lot more of that in the last, less than the last decade. Seems to be using for plugging the holes, as it were. There's a story from San Francisco about parking tickets, and they've gotten so out of hand with the parking tickets there that someone has created an app and created a service to automatically contest and fight parking tickets for you, which is a great example of how the free market reacts when government gets way out of control. When it gets to the point that somebody has started a service to fight parking tickets for you because it's so out of control. But that's what we're facing. And we have real opportunities to make change. It's not like it was. We have the ability to really see things get better if we want them to get better. But it is going to take work, and we are going to have to stand up, and we're going to have to do that work. It can't just be, well, somebody else will do it. It can't just be, well, it doesn't matter anyway. It can't just be this nonchalant, uncaring attitude. It does take people to stand up, to put the time in, to volunteer, to find something that you're passionate about and work toward it. And it does make a difference. It absolutely does make a difference. A small, dedicated group can make all the difference in the world. I'm way over for a break. Folks, we're going to take a break here. When we come back, we'll bring Dave and we'll talk, and we invite you to call in as well. The number here, area code 858-683-1326. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters Radio Network. Back in a few minutes.
First impressions aren't the most important thing. They're the only thing. At Ernie's Print Shop, we'll produce what you need to represent your company professionally. Right now, you can get 1,000 full-color business cards, 1,000 4x6 postcards, or a 3x5 banner for just $60. You choose. Check us out at erniesprintshop.com. Ernie's Print Shop. Over 50 years, one source, one solution. erniesprintshop.com. 502-969-8585.
Being a victim of crime is no joke, but you do have options that can help you avoid becoming a victim. I'm Ed Springsteen of the My View Matters radio show, and on behalf of myself and co-host Ed Martin, I urge each of you to help us fight against crime. You can do your part by calling Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE. Since 1982, Crime Stoppers has helped get over 23,000 criminals off the street with your help. Working together, we can make a difference to take our streets back. Please call Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE, or you can visit them online at www.582clue.com. Remember, Crime Stoppers always offers up to a $1,000 reward. Get involved and help make a positive change in your neighborhood. Thanks.
Advertisers, here's a great way to reach a quality audience. Get heard on My View Matters and make some noise in the marketplace.
Email MyViewMatters at AOL.com for advertising opportunities. Make a sound investment.
All right, folks, and we're back. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network. And if you'd like to call in, the number here is area code 858-683-1326. And we do like when people call in live. But, Dave, I think you've joined us here. Co-host Dave is on the line. What are your thoughts, sir? Dave,
are
you there?
There. Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, sir.
You know, I got to thinking as you were talking about, you know, the way that the landscape's changing and, you know, the amount of civic involvement that we don't really seem to have that seems to be going away. But I don't think that it's what it looks like. You know, you mentioned that the millennials is kind of a group that tends to just, you know, not vote, not be involved. And, you know, I know quite a few millennials, and, you know, they don't vote. But I know quite a few millennials that are very they're very well informed. They're very well educated. They are, in fact, civic-minded, and they are not going to the polls with reason. In other words, they're actually exercising, you know, their right, you know, to vote by educating themselves on, you know, who the candidates are, and actively deciding that there's nobody worth voting for, and so it's not worth them getting up off of their butts and, you know, getting down to the polling place. And as a libertarian, I've got to say that I definitely do not disagree, you know, with, you know, that view. I disagree if you're not educating yourself, you know, about it at all. But, you know, if there's nobody that you believe in, why would you go vote for somebody?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a very good point. You know, with the modern era of politics, everything's about negative campaigning now. It's all about this person's worse than me, so vote for me because you don't want this worse person. And that's not an inspiring message. That doesn't inspire people to act. And I had a conversation with someone about that actually yesterday or today or someday recently, that that's in part what led to Obama's election, is that he talked about positive changes, talked about, you know, making a difference, talked about being a positive, and basically ran on positives, making things better. And that is something that, despite his failure to do so, it is an effective strategy. And I've said that for years now, that people are sick and tired of the negative campaigning. Everybody knows what the freaking problems are. There's no mistake what the problems are. We want answers. What are you going to do? How are you going to fix our problems? And that answer can be anything from some broad-based plan to a very specific plan to even just, hey, we're just not going to stop doing X, Y, and Z and let things fix themselves. But it needs to be outlined.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I think that the young folks, I think they get a really, really bad rap. You know, we tend to look at them like they're, you know, like they just don't care. And there's a very, now, you know, look, there are an awful lot of people that are, you know, old in between and young, you know, that just don't care. That's true. But I think that the extreme majority of people do care, and when it comes to the young folks that aren't voting, I think they're not voting because they do care. You know, they've grown up in a different time, and I think it's a good thing. I think we're headed towards, you know, something much better. I think we're in the middle of a, you know, an intellectual renaissance, you know, in this country, not just in Kentucky, you know, but everywhere. And, you know, those young folks that don't seem to be paying attention, they're paying more attention than we give them credit for. And if they're not voting, in a lot of cases, they're not voting because they don't have anything to vote for. But you give them something to vote for, and they'll get out there, number one. And number two, and I think that this is the more important point, you know, some of them are getting to the point where they're so fed up that rather than just not being involved, they're starting to get involved. And, you know, they're becoming, you know, candidates. You know, they're the candidates of today and tomorrow. And that's what we have to look forward to, is people that are really ticked off and really motivated and very educated, and they've been paying attention.
And I have to agree. I'll tell you, you know, in doing what I do, I run into a lot of people not necessarily running as libertarians or not even necessarily a partisan office, but I do see a lot of younger folks getting involved in politics and very, very sharp people. Some of them do lack a little bit of the, you know, wisdom of the world, right, things that come with age. But those are things that are easily overcome. That's just a matter of time. You know, I think you're dead on that, given that we are in an information age with the power of the internet and the ability to be able to get information from so many different sources, that it is easier than ever to be informed on an issue. If you want to know about an issue, go to Google, type it in. There's more information there than you could ever want to know. You know, you can start from Wikipedia and go from there. There's so many resources to learn about a particular issue, if it tickles your fancy, to do that. And I think that's a wonderful thing. I mean, I've myself found myself lost in the wiki hole, you know, looking at information about something in particular. It's very easy to find yourself lost in information, that there's actually too much information you know, keep it all straight or to digest it in one setting. But if you're passionate about a particular issue, it is entirely possible to, you know, learn as much as you want about that thing. And it's not like the old days where it was really hard to learn. It's very easy to learn. And I do think that there are a lot of people that are taking the time to learn about issues that are important to them.
Yeah. You know, as we're talking here, I'm thinking about some kind of, you know, catchphrases and generational gaps. You know, I'm thinking of the catchphrases respect authority and question authority, and the generational gaps and kind of, you know, what we've seen with those, you know, cultural understandings of what those phrases mean. And I think for a long time, you know, we had people that, you know, said, you know, respect authority, you know, and the way to respect authority was to, you know, sit idly by and allow it to do what it's going to do. Then we had kind of a move, you know, against that. It was relatively short, and it was, you know, questioning authority. I think the problem with that the first time around is that the questioning of authority at the time was done in such a way that it was very disrespectful. Mm-hmm. I think what we've moved to now is kind of, you know, it's respect authority again, only it's respect authority by, you know, not questioning them, but by, you know, keeping it to yourself. And I think the next generation, and, you know, I can speak to direct involvement, and, you know, some of you can blame me for this because, you know, we're a homeschooling family. This is exactly what I teach my kids, and that is you respect authority by questioning authority.
Yes.
You don't have to question disrespectfully.
No, and that, you know, and that's a very good point. You know, it's – within libertarian circles, there's often a knee-jerk reaction to certain scenarios that cause situations to devolve into, you know, a pejorative name-calling contest rather than actually having a rational debate about an issue. And it's not just libertarians. I mean, heck, you see that every day where, you know, politicians try to boil things down to bumper sticker slogans and then throw them at each other as if that really is going to fix something.
Right.
I don't know of a bumper sticker slogan that's actually solved a problem. If somebody can come up with one, please let me know. But I haven't thought, there's not a single bumper sticker slogan I've ever seen that's like, oh, geez, that's the answer. Because the issues we face are complex, and you can't sum them up in three or four words. There has to be an actual thought-out answer, a rationalized answer. And then it has to be boiled down into something that those that aren't necessarily paying attention can understand and rationalize themselves easily and digest that information quickly. Because just because people are gaining information about a particular issue, it doesn't mean that they're up to speed on the issue that you're speaking of at that moment. So you have to be able to pique people's interest by making it something that's thoughtful, rational, and also, you know, not talking above or talking down to someone. It does need to be a respectful conversation, and whether that's with authority or with just other people, you know, that's the kind of stuff that respectful debate is actually one of the lost arts in our society, I believe. I love a good debate, and one of the things that depresses me more than anything is that KET, right, Kentucky Educational Television, used to actually hold candidate debates, and they've switched that format over to a forum. And it kind of bums me out because as one who did policy debate in high school, one that's a big fan of debate in general, I see the benefits of having a good debate on issues. You hammer everything out. There's the back and the forth, and it's all very structured. In a forum setting, it can devolve into more of that pejorative or it's I don't want to say necessarily less intellectual, but it's not as structured. And it can be biased, and it can be driven by a moderator, or it can be driven by, you know, somebody who's just forcefully using more time or whatever. I think it's important to actually engage in rational discussions and debates with others that we disagree with, because that's the only way we gain understanding of that other person's position and then try to make them understand ours.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, and I do think that – I don't think that it's a lost art. I think that it's just, you know, it's one of those things that it's been pushed in the closet. It hasn't really been given enough emphasis. It's one of those things that, you know, this – you're speaking directly to one of the reasons that we don't hear as much from our younger folks as, you know, we might expect. And the thing is that, we've been telling our young people for years and years to, you know, sit down and shut up. And, you know, when you do that, you know, then you expect them to stand up and talk. It doesn't work out that well. And so that is one of those things that you know, unless you're actively seeking it, it's very difficult to find anymore. It's very difficult to find people that are willing to engage in those kind of educational instructions about how to go about having a peaceful debate.
Yeah, you know, that's always been one of the things I always taught my kids was, above all else, I try to teach them ways to think for themselves, to interact for themselves. I don't try to teach them what to think. I try to teach them how to think. I think that that's learning how to process information and understand it is far more important than just getting information beat into your head. Now, certainly there's information you do need to have beat into your head. There are certain core things, early on in schooling that you're going to use forever and you need them. But beyond that, I think it's important for individuals. Go ahead.
Let me engage you in a bit of debate right now. I'd like to challenge you on that. Please name for me one thing that does in fact need to, you know, the what as opposed to the how to think and decide for yourself needs to be beaten into somebody's head at an early age.
I when I was saying it, I was specifically thinking of things like the times table, right? The ability to be able to quickly do basic math because you just know it. Real basic stuff. I'm not talking about anything super specific. I'm talking about real basic skills.
I kind of thought that maybe that's what you were, you know, talking about. And I was thinking about mathematics as you were mentioning that. However, I am a conceptual learner, and it's funny. There's a meme that's going around about the whole Common Core, you know, debacle that is, you know, overtaking our country and the, you know, education right now.
Yeah.
The meme is so far off base. It's crazy. There are tons and tons and tons of reasons to be against Common Core, but the way that Common Core handles math isn't one of them. That is not one of the reasons to be upset with Common Core. It is a different way, that is true. And most people that were taught their timetables, for example, they don't quite understand even what it means, because the way that math is taught inside of that curriculum is the same way that it's taught in Montessori curriculum, and that is it's conceptual. So the basis for how you know, everything is put together, how numbers are multiplied, divided, how they relate to addition and subtraction, you know, basic arithmetic, that's actually what drives all of that. It's a conceptual way to go about learning mathematics. And I am a conceptual learner. So I struggled with mathematics when I was young because I was not taught in a conceptual way. I was taught with times tables and whatnot, and, you know, just facts. These are the things you have to memorize, and, you know, that's that. Mm-hmm. So I struggled pretty fiercely. It wasn't until later in life that I even learned that there were methods, you know, by which you could learn math conceptually. And I would have been far better off at an early age if I had learned conceptually rather than just the facts.
Well, and I'm not going to debate that point. I mean, I think different people do learn different ways, and I think that having, or I shouldn't say disagree with it. Different people learn in different ways. People are wired differently. There's just, and you know, having kids myself, it becomes very obvious when you've got kids that kids are just wired different. People are just wired differently from the start. And you know, having had three kids, you know, each one of them is very unique. It's not like we're pumping out automatons of ourselves or carbon copies. And so certainly I understand the need to have the ability to learn in different ways. I think that there are still some rules that you're going to have to learn. Another one that just came up in my head before was the Pythagorean theorem, right? The whole a squared plus b squared equals c squared thing. And that's something that I actually use a lot in life, amazingly. Never thought I would when I learned it, but boy, do I use that a lot. And I don't know that you can necessarily conceptualize that per se. I think that that's something that just – you just got to know.
We're getting short on time. We're getting close to the end here. But I'll talk to you later. And just to give our listeners kind of a heads up, maybe we'll post something on the website about it. But we send our daughter to a Montessori school for co-op. She goes there 2 days a week. And we just went in for math night a few weeks ago where they talked to us and they taught us how they teach math in the Montessori way. And there is definitely a conceptual way to learn the Pythagorean theorem. I'll show it to you, and you'll love it. It's so easy.
Well,
everybody
and
in
I should
room,
mention
all
quick,
of the adults, none of them remember. But they all
and
knew.
Just,
they all knew when they walked out.
As we're running out of time here, I just want to remind folks our website, we do have that up and running now. You go to libertyunbridled.com. We're there. Folks, we are out of time. Dave, thank you very much. Folks, thanks for listening. Tune in next week for another edition of Liberty Unbridled here on the My View Matters Radio Network. We're here every week, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And listen to the other shows on the network here Monday through Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Until next time, everybody have a good week. We'll see you soon.